Good evening. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished patent speaker, Professor Werner Solers. Professor Solers earned his doctorate at the Free University of Berlin in 1975 and subsequently taught in Berlin at Columbia University and the Università degli Studi di Venezia, joining the Harvard faculty in 1983, where he is currently the Henry B. and Anne M. Cabot Professor of English and Professor of African American Studies. Professor Solers also chaired the Department of Afro-American Studies from 1984 to 1987, and then again from 1988 to 1990. In addition to being the recipient of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellowship, he was elected as a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2000. The Austrian Academy of Sciences and the Bavarian American Academy similarly honored his scholarship by awarding him membership in their organizations. As his Harvard appointments might indicate, Professor Solers' research has centered on African American literature, ethnicity, modernism, and culture. Authoring and editing 25 books and over 100 articles, his research has helped to complicate our understanding of ethnicity and American identity. Professor Solers' writing on ethnicity carefully traces the etymology of the term, going back to the Greek ethnos for nation and people, and its Latin derivation, ethnicus, to refer to people who are not Christian or Jewish. He tracks the shifts in the meaning of the term between designating a kind of primordial collective sense of shared descent and distinct cultural traditions on the one hand, and as signifying radical difference from the mainstream on the other. Professor Solers argues for a view of ethnicity as a modern self-conscious construct that eschews absolutist definitions and acknowledges the transformations which arise as cultures inevitably intermingle. This view of ethnicity has enabled him to rewrite the cultural history of the United States in ways that are nuanced and recognize the continuous interactions between different groups of people as expressed in literature and other cultural artifacts. In an early article, Theory and Ethnic Message, published in 1981, Professor Solers urges scholars to, quote, understand the dynamic nature of the national and subcultural definitions of literature, end quote, and, quote, to be alert to cross-cultural influences and polyethnic dialogues as they exist in the United States, end quote. In his call in the same essay to recognize cultural nationalism and ethnicity as a historical phenomenon, Professor Solers also emphasizes the importance of understanding both terms in relation to international influences and events, thereby presaging the recent trend in American studies toward transnational categories of analysis. While Professor Solers' contribution to scholarship will be immediately obvious to those in English, American studies, and German, his talk on Tuesday night was on African Americans traveling to Germany and to Spain. Those working in cultural studies have also benefited from his research. His book, Beyond Ethnicity, Consent and Dissent in American Culture, for example, models cultural analysis at its best. Treating works from every period of American history, Professor Solers argues that American identity is constituted by a dialectic between dissent, the desire to emphasize what another patent lecturer, Edward Said, calls the filiative ties of birth and ethnicity, and consent, the desire to create what Said terms new affiliative bonds of alternative communities. Professor Solers' innovation is to deconstruct the two terms by demonstrating how they are mutually constitutive. Literature in Solers' study becomes a sign of cultural shifts, opening the door to an analysis of non-literary forms of culture. Thus, the study ranges over readings of the biblical Exodus, melting pot romances, and the post-punk science fiction film. In this sense, Beyond Ethnicity demonstrates a cultural studies approach for American materials. Along with a sustained engagement with ethnicity and American identity, as evidenced in his books such as Neither Black Nor White, Yet Both, and edited collections such as Interracialism, Black-White Intermarriage in American History, Literature, and Law, Professor Solers has given greater visibility to the multilingual inheritance of the United States by publishing the anthologies Creole Echoes, The Francophone Poetry of 19th Century Louisiana, the Multilingual Anthology of American Literature, and Multilingual America, Transnationalism, Ethnicity, and the Languages of America. Part of this work is conducted in Professor Solers' capacity as a co-director, along with Mark Schells, of the Longfellow Institute at Harvard, whose mission is to reinvigorate the English language tradition in the context of American multilingualism by identifying, studying, and publicizing American texts written in indigenous Amerindian languages, Western and Eastern European languages, Asian languages, and Arabic. The title of his talk tonight is Hail Johnny, Billy Wilder's A Foreign Affair, or the Denazification of Erika von Schlotto. Please join me in welcoming Professor Solers.
switch on some technology here. There we go. So thank you very, very much for this beautiful introduction. And thank everybody one more time, as I did 2 days ago, for this whirlwind tour of 2 days. The only similarly intense experience I ever had in my life was in a pub crawl in Dublin. That didn't last for 3 days, however. The section I'm going to read you today is part of a new project that I'm in the middle of doing. Each entry has a dateline and a kind of heading, and then a more dictionary-style title. So the full dateline for today's talk would be August 16, 1945. Billy Wilder proposes propaganda through entertainment to the Information Control Division of the American military government, arguing that the novelty of showing newsreels and documentaries to German audiences has worn off, and offering to make an entertainment film instead that could be a very special love story cleverly devised to help us sell a few ideological items. And the general title I don't have to read anymore. So the Berlin entertainer Erika von Schlüter, is it working?
I think we need to make you a little louder, really.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Joe, I'm not sure I'm doing it.
I think it's this one.
Oh, well, okay.
I put it closer to my...
Sorry about that.
Okay. Is it better? Rep? Better now?
Oh, that would help.
There's nothing. It's only here. Whoop.
Can you want to just say test, test?
Test, test, test.
Okay. Okay. I'm right. Sorry.
So the Berlin entertainer Erika von Schlüter is a loose woman compromised by her past. At 11 a.m., she is still in bed in her ruined apartment and lets her derriere cover the U.S. Army stencil on the blanket she has procured by fraternizing with Captain John Pringle. When John asks about her mismatched pajamas, how the heck does anybody lose the top of one and the bottom of the other? Erika wisecracks, Johnny, you didn't know the Nazi party, as if that had been a kind of a pajama party, I guess. In the Lorelei, the nightclub of ill repute where Erika performs, she raises her silken buttocks to the piano, described as a Rhine maiden, a Valkyrie, but a maiden who had gone off the deep end, and a Valkyrie who had ridden the wrong way. She was an active Nazi from 1935 until the end of the war and wears a dress that must have been pillaged from Schiaparelli the first day the Nazis took over Paris. When the Iowa congresswoman, tellingly named Phoebe Frost, who has come to Berlin on a congressional committee investigating the morale of American troops, feels manipulated by Erika, she asks bitterly, what is this, Munich all over again? Erika is not just a woman then, but an allegory of post-war Germany, deeply compromised by its Nazi past. At times, John's attraction to Erika seems to be fired up by such associations. Having admitted to her that he cleared her Nazi files with his own signature, John asks, how about a kiss now, you beast of Belsen? The term circulated widely in reference to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp commandant Josef Kramer, who was sentenced to death in 1945. Wait a minute, you may say at this point, this is not the Erika von Schlüter I remember from Billy Wilder's film A Foreign Affair. And you're absolutely right. For this is Erika as she appeared in an earlier story treatment and in the pre-censorship script. In later stages, all these passages were deleted, and in Wilder's film, John addresses Erika not as a beast of Belsen, but as a gorgeous booby trap, which he follows up with a shout of delight, Yahoo. The term booby trap was actually popularized in that context by Eisenhower, who referred to European prostitutes as booby traps, and added more men were knocked out by this variety than by the real article. So in short, Erika's German allegory changed from a scandalous and opportunistic Nazi whom John can happily leave for an American woman to an irresistibly attractive femme fatale who simply had and has to make some compromises. So what accounts for this dramatic transformation? In 1945, when Wilder proposed to the Information Control Division making an entertainment film that was a very special love story, what did he have in mind? And how does it relate to the film that emerged from this proposal? The answers will take us to storylines proposed, considered, and discarded, to remnants of Paramount-owned plots, fresh materials, revisions and concessions made to censorship requests, a confusing array of sources that left traces in the film and make it difficult to date the time of the action with any precision between 1946 and 1948. Wilder's original plot outline, a very simple story of an American GI stationed with the occupational troops and a German Frau whose husband, an Oberleutnant in the Luftwaffe, had been killed in action over Tunisia, was, he explained to the ICD, inspired by a chance encounter in Berlin with a woman clearing rubble on Kurfürstendamm in August 1945. Quote, I had thrown away a cigarette, and she had picked up the butt, Wilder wrote, and a conversation ensued in which the woman said casually that she would turn on the gas once it was working again, but not light it. Why? Because we Germans have nothing to live for anymore. Wilder responded, if you call living for Hitler a life, I guess you're right. Then offered her a brand new lucky strike that she did not take. Instead, she went back to clearing rubble. This conversation inspired Wilder to make the proposal to shoot the film. Right here in this piece of dialogue is the theme of the picture, and here is the simple ending I want to arrive at. When the gas finally is turned on, our German Frau strikes a match to cook her dinner, a few measly potatoes, I grant you, but now that a few facts have dawned on her, she has something new to live for. That is what the film should state, in Eisenhower's words, that we're not here to degrade the German people, but to make it impossible to wage war. And in the end, let us give them a little hope to redeem themselves in the eyes of the world. This background story would hardly seem appropriate for an Eisenhower-inspired contribution to propaganda through entertainment. It sounds more like a Billy Wilder-specific effort to use the medium of bittersweet film comedy as a suicide prevention program. Yet he did get the green light from the ICD, probably because his old friend Erich Pommer, the erstwhile producer of The Blue Angel, had become the chief of the film section of the Information Control Division. Billy Wilder had been born in 1906 into the Jewish family of Maximilian and Eugenia Wilda in a Galician village near Krakow, had gone to school in Vienna, and had written scripts for and then directed several films in Berlin, one in Paris, and many more in the United States. He was not yet 40, and at the peak of his career at Paramount, after the success of Double Indemnity in 1944, and especially after the last weekend of 1945, received 4 Oscars. It was easy for a friend in the ICD to accept the proposal of such a distinguished Hollywood director. Wilder left for Europe the day after VE Day and worked for the Film, Theater, and Music Control section of the Psychological Warfare Division. I always love all these names of the occupation. There's no euphemism in the air. He had his fill in confronting the horrors of the recent past. Most importantly, he tried to find out what had happened to his own mother. His father had died in Berlin in 1927, yet managed to learn only that she had perished. Details emerged much later. She was deported to the concentration camp Placów, Krakow, in 1943 at age 58, and was murdered either there or after a transport to Auschwitz. His stepfather and grandmother were also killed. Wilder participated in the denazification effort, interviewing Nazi filmmakers and actors, among them Werner Krauss, who had starred in the anti-Semitic film Jud Süß, and he proposed to Erich Pommer not only the filming of a topical comedy, but also the reconstructing of the German film industry. Wilder edited down the horrifying concentration camp documentary Death Mills, the Todesmühlen, a version of which was shown to German audiences in 1946. It includes footage of camps, of barely surviving victims, and of masses of corpses, as well as of Germans reacting with horror and shame to Allied enforced visits to liberated camps. He flew with a cameraman over the destroyed and devastated city of Berlin, the city where his career as filmmaker had begun, and found that it now looked like the end of the world. Against such grim backgrounds, Wilder still wanted to create a comedy. Paramount owned an undated comic story treatment called Love in the Air, written by Irwin Shaw and David Shaw. It's a silly wartime story that takes the old yarn of a sailor with a girl in every port literally into the air, and is remarkably different from Wilder's 1945 sketch. The hero is Jasper McKay, who has an Iowa fiancé named Leona, but wants to visit the various girls he's met in the course of the war in Rome, Paris, Moscow, Frankfurt, Cairo, and Sydney to make sure that marrying Leona would be the best choice for him. His colonel assigns him to a representative Kinnicott of the United States Congress, assimilated rank of major general, who is making a tour of army installations throughout the world. It turns out that Kinnicott is a congresswoman, and after visits to Jasper's girlfriends all over the world, he finds out that not one single one of his girls still really wants him, not even his fiancée, Leona, to whom this the congresswoman flies him last. So Jasper is depressed and angrily blames the congresswoman for having ruined 6 marriages for him. And he says, "I'm without a woman now, and you are the cause." The script ends with Representative Kinnicott's sly reply to Jasper McKay, "Well, not exactly completely without one," implying a match between McKay and Kinnicott after the end of the script. So this man's tale of airborne Don Juanism of the unrequited kind, cured by a scheming congresswoman, gave Wilder little more than the motif of a womanizing soldier's choice among homegirl, foreign girls, and congresswoman. The next stage was a third-person prose treatment of re-education written by Billy Wilder, Charles Brackett, and Robert Harari, already titled A Foreign Affair, and dated May 31st, 1947. Here, the outline of the later film and even some dialogue bits that would be used are already present. The central constellation of John, torn between the beautifully molded Erica and the maidenly Phoebe, is also there. Since Erica sings the song Falling in Love Again in the Lorelei associated with Marlene Dietrich, one thinks already of Marlene Dietrich, though she has not yet been involved in the project at all, except that, as has already become clear, this earlier Erica is far less sympathetic than she would turn out to be in the later film. The concluding scene is a sham wedding of John and Erica staged by the army in a ruined church in order to lure her high-ranking consort Otto von Bergel out of hiding. Erica, wise by now, and ever an opportunist, seeks her luck in a car with Russian officers and asks them to take her to the Russian zone, for no one can like the Americans. They are swine. They make me clean up the Berlin streets. But the Russians promise to take her to Stalingrad, and the Americans arrest Bergel. This leaves little ambiguity at the end as John returns to America with Phoebe. His relationship with Erica was merely a fling that can be ended without regrets, and her affection for him was purely self-serving. We don't feel sad that the Russians promised to make Erica work hard in Stalingrad. Although John does not get any final lines to say so, we feel that he'll probably be happy with Phoebe at the end. The German everywoman Erica does not offer an inviting alternative or future, for she is fickle. Her alliance with the harbinger of American democracy may be nothing more than an interlude between one totalitarian past and another totalitarian future. This glum allegorization of Germany was disrupted only in the final stages of the film project. Sometime between May and November 1947, Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett must have decided to add complexity to Erica's character, and therefore more ambiguity and more life to the love triangle of the plot. The transformation of Erica's character also parallels American attitudes toward Germany from a more punitive posture to a more collaborative one, as the inklings of the coming Cold War made for new alliances, which did, however, not at all affect Wilder's portrayal of the Russians in the film as genial drunkards and black market dupes, rather than as potential military antagonists. So it was ironic when the film ultimately was released, was just for the in time for the blockade, and the Russians are all, you know, gay and singing drinking songs. It was also in the summer of 1947 that Wilder was able to sign up Marlene Dietrich to play Erika, whom he always wanted for the part, and for whom Friedrich Holländer would write the songs, as he had done in The Blue Angel. Apparently, Wilder went to see Dietrich with some mock-up footage of a minor actress playing Erika's part very badly, and Innocent asked Dietrich for advice, until she agreed that the role could only be played by her. In her autobiography, Marlene Dietrich remembers the encounter differently. Billy Wilder had already called her, and she had declined to play a Nazi woman, but then he came to Paris to see her and persuade her to accept, and she found that it was simply impossible to resist him. Wilder also told one of his biographers, she was so much against the Nazis that at first she didn't like playing someone who had slept with one. I said, Marlene, you're an actress. You are to play a part, not join the Nazi party. Now, the scenic version, Operation Candy Bar, authored by Wilder Brackett and Richard Breen and dated November 20th, 1947, was submitted to Stephen Jackson at the Industry's Self-Censoring Production Code Administration, and the PCA reacted vigilantly that the material presents a very serious problem and would be brought to the attention of the president of the PCA. The characterization of the members of the Congressional Committee and of members of the American Army of Occupation was part of the complaint. The PCA also deemed that the portrayal of the Congresswoman Phoebe Frost getting drunk in a public nightclub of poor reputation violated the production code stipulation that, quote, the history, institutions, prominent people, and citizenry of all nations shall be represented fairly. The PCA took specific issue with the overemphasis on illicit sex, which seemed to run through most of the script and was especially prominent in the relationship between Captain Pringle and Erika, which needed to be eliminated in order to make the approval of the film possible. Finally, the portrayal of wholesale and universal activities in the black market on the part of the occupation personnel also constituted a code violation. A meticulously detailed listing of more than 24 specifically objectionable sequences in the script followed, more than 20 of them considered overly sex suggestive or too much focused on lust and excessive passion. The letter ended with the invitation to resubmit the changed script, but also with the threat that final judgment will be based on the finished picture. And one of the issues was also specifically raised, at all times Erika must be fully clothed, and on this slide you can barely make out the matching handwritten marginal annotation to this scene by the censor is, this guy just walks in while she's in bed and it's okay with her? So Billy Wilder's Paramount team must have gone through these requests very carefully, for a few substantial changes were made. In A Foreign Affair, Erika is no longer lying in bed when John arrives, wears some kind of a bathrobe, and is brushing her teeth, but their lustful and passionate attitude is unmistakable nonetheless. Many of the differences between Operation Candy Bar and the censorship and release dialogue scripts of April 24th and May 20th, 1948, can thus be accounted for by the action of the PCA, yet neither the sexual innuendo nor the political bite was substantially diminished in the revising process, and Wilder managed to leave much objectionable material in script and film. Furthermore, there are changes that make apparently harmless scenes somewhat more titillating, though what one actually sees on screen would not have to be different. For example, in the pre-censorship version, a short take is described, a German nurse wheeling a baby carriage down the street. As the baby's parents are American, the carriage is decorated with two small American flags. In the post-censorship version, one reads simply, long shot, German girl wheeling baby carriage, which is decorated with two American flags. So the suggestion that this must be an illegitimate baby of an American soldier rather than the child of American parents accompanied by a German nurse is strengthened. Wilder and Brackett also came up with a whole number of new funny lines, including John's response to Erica's kiss, "Gently, baby, it's Mother's Day." In a scene in which Phoebe searches for Erica von Schluto's file and John starts to kiss her in order to hide Erica's file from her, Phoebe originally recites the Constitution, which caused no concern to censors, in her attempt at filibustering the amorous-seeming John. In the final version, it is Longfellow's Midnight Ride of Paul Revere with its dramatic opening, "Listen!" On the whole, the revising made the dialogue stronger and funnier. Wilder mentioned in an interview that he had thought of a stronger version that he tried on Charles Brackett. "What I wanted to do was, not only is Captain Pringle in the American Army, he was also Jewish. That is going to really cement it, you know. The American lieutenant with whom Dietrich is having an affair is going to marry is Jewish." What? She's going to marry a dot, dot, dot? "That picture I would have loved to make," Billy Wilder said, "but then we chickened out and we just made him an American." Needless to say, this discarded plot possibility, which Wilder also apparently would have ended with Erica's and Jewish John's real marriage, because that's what he said in this interview, would have created a somewhat different film. This anecdote throws light on the fact that race is absent as a theme, though concentration camps and gas chambers are mentioned in a comic context. There is no allusion to Nazi genocidal anti-Semitism and no representation of any black GIs anywhere in Berlin. When the film was finally completed under the title of Foreign Affair, officially released on August 30th, 1948, it bore very little resemblance to Wilder's original proposal. The desperate German rubblefrau had become an entertainer who is anything but suicidal. She has not been married and widowed, but now has a jealous Gestapo officer ex-boyfriend who has gone underground. The simple German love story was transformed into an intricate post-war triangle with the American officer of dubious morality torn between a censured German and a respectable American woman, both of whom want him. And triangular shots are very common in the film, showing Johnny always torn between the two possible love interests. Pretty much all that was left from the story of the German lieutenant's suicidal widow was now in the Indianan occupation officer, thanks, by the way, for reminding me of that, of the Indianan occupation officer Colonel Blummer's brief statement in one of his addresses to the congressional delegation. "I remember the first day the gas works started operating again. There were 160 suicides in Berlin alone. That was 10 months ago. Today, they take a match and light the gas and boil themselves some potatoes. Not many potatoes, mind you. There's still a lot of hunger, but there is a new will to live." In the film, A Foreign Affair, Captain John Pringle, played by John Lund after Wilder failed to get Clark Gable for the part, is shown a nylon stocking dangling from his, for his German sweetheart, Erica, dangling from his pocket, receiving a birthday cake from his Iowa girlfriend, Dusty, a trace of Jasper's Iowa fiancée, Leona, from Love in the Air. The cake gets delivered by Congresswoman Phoebe Frost, played by Jean Arthur, who is part of the predominantly Republican committee that flies into Tempelhof Airport. Phoebe is shocked at the extent of fraternization she witnesses and, you know, records in her notebook. She herself pretends to be a Fräulein and permits two GIs to pick her up and take her to the Lorelei nightclub where Dietrich sings the Black Market song. Pringle attempts to save Erica from a denazification trial, and Phoebe tries to find the American protector of the Nazi entertainer, unable to imagine that it could be her Johnny. Erica is a sophisticated and charming woman whose involvement in the Nazi party becomes clearer only later to John. Phoebe is a plain-looking, repressed, puritanical politician at the beginning who discovers a more romantic and aesthetic side in herself only with John and amidst the ruins of Berlin. Phoebe's softening from an ideologically hard-hearted and sexually repressed politician. This is from the story treatment at the beginning on the plane. Reminded a number of viewers of Ernst Lubitsch's film Ninotchka from 1939, for which Billy Wilder was actually one of the scriptwriters, which is to say that Wilder's female representative of American democracy is as stuck up as was Lubitsch's female embodiment of Soviet ideology. Remember, Ninotchka's most famous line was, "The show trials were a big success. There are fewer but better Russians now." This was the pre-falling in love, tough Soviet Ninotchka. And will John stay with his forbidden erotic German lover, Erika, or will he follow the Republican congresswoman? Wilder's final film version offers the plot resolution that John, on explicit orders from Colonel Plummer, played by Millard Mitchell, and who is something of a magic helper in the whole plot, has to pretend to continue being enamored by Erika in order to smoke out Erika's former and extremely jealous lover, Birgel. The love commando, as Colonel Plummer calls John's dangerous mission sarcastically, making him a target. This is one of the scenes where the target is drawn on the window of Tempelhof Airport, and then the fade in to Johnny, the target possibly of Birgel shooting him. The mission is successful, and Birgel gets killed in a scene that substituted for the earlier story treatment's sham wedding. It is the last musical number in the Lorelei, Marlene Dietrich singing The Ruins of Berlin. Now, John may be headed toward a more serious relationship with Phoebe after the end of the movie, even though one of the romantic things he tells Phoebe along the way is that now that he's met her, he knows how he'll cast his next absentee ballot. I think it's about the greatest courtship sentence one can say. He is, in his own and quite believable words, just a hit-and-run boy, not the marrying kind, and one can hardly imagine him back in Iowa with all the urban sophistication he has acquired, although Phoebe, too, has changed in her few days in Berlin, not as dramatically and convincingly, however, as did Ninotchka. At the end, Erika is arrested by two young MPs who are so enthusiastic escorting her after she adjusts her stockings and shows her beautiful legs to them that Colonel Plummer sends two more soldiers to guard the guards and another one to guard the guards who guard the guards. But one feels at the end, who really knows what Marlene Dietrich's charm cannot accomplish with however many guards. So ends the movie of a complex and somewhat unresolved love triangle, for as Wilder did at times, the viewer thinks of John and Erika as the romantic couple, not of John and Phoebe. Wilder clearly shows sympathies for Colonel Plummer, the symbol of democracy and re-education, but also for the lively and beautiful Erika, who lives in a ruin and is, after all, always Marlene Dietrich, the glamorous anti-fascist wartime entertainer of US troops, only reluctantly playing a former Nazi. The inner open-endedness of the film is driven home by the advertising campaign that accompanied it. Thus, there was a poster made of a two-column ad that reads, I have this, how did I get stuck in this? I don't know. I have to move. Did I already show this? Oh, I know. Okay, you don't have this slide because I changed the PowerPoint. So let's just go back to here where we were. So you have to take my word for it. You won't get the slide for this. A two-column ad that reads, "Meet Johnny. He can't decide between a Fraulein with a chassis and an Iowa lassie." Ideas for the film's promotion included leg contests in which contestants were judged for legs that most resembled Dietrich's, and a campaign to inspire department stores and specialty shops to place a small card in every package of nylons that they sell saying, "Marlene Dietrich flatters nylons in a foreign affair." Nothing the Iowa lassie wore or was seemed especially publicity worthy. The previews seemed to be willfully misleading in suggesting that a foreign affair was about some international intrigue, and showing a series of witnesses of different nationalities in various capitals who attest that the movie is very funny. Hence, the first showings must have held some surprise. When A Foreign Affair was released, One would have expected skeptical reactions to a plotline that hardly seemed devised to sell a few ideological items, and only a sparingly revised script that had so worried the industry's self-censoring agency. The critical literature makes mention of a supposedly negative official reaction by Army and Congress, yet all these comments lack a credible source citation, and no records have been found to document either a worried response by the Army or a congressional debate about the film. Ralph Willett has a footnote in which he said, anyone who finds evidence in the congressional record, please write to me, in an article of 1982. I wrote him an email in the fall, and he said nobody ever answered the footnote, and he had never heard it. But there are half a dozen books in the meantime that say that there was a reaction by the Army. So it's possible that all these references go back to two sentences in Bosley Crowther's wholly positive New York Times review. Congress may not like this picture, and even the Department of the Army may find it a shade embarrassing. For Brackett and Wilder are here making light of regulations and the gravity of officialdom in a smoothly sophisticated and slyly sardonic way. But apparently neither Congress nor Army ever reacted, and the film opened to uniformly enthusiastic reviews. Bosley Crowther put it later on into the 10 best films of 1948, and the blurbs that the publicity machine used justified blurbs from literally a unanimous positive. I was looking desperately, but I have to find one negative review, and I did. There was a member of the Screenwriters Guild, Herbert G. Luft, who published an attack on Billy Wilder, calling him a decadent filmmaker. It's an attack on his whole oeuvre in an academic journal, of course, needless to say. Found Wilder's unhealthy boulevard witticism at work in A Foreign Affair, and specifically complained about the movie's easygoing attitude toward Nazis, seen as double-crossers, yet drawn with much charm and noblesse, living in an atmosphere of comparative ease with a romantic facade covering up a decade of mass murders. Those praising the guts of the story didn't see the malefic travesty. Now, Charles Brackett, of course, the co-scriptwriter with Wilder of the movie, felt the need to respond and refute the diatribe point by point. The Berlin woman, played by Marlene Dietrich, was such a complete heavy, is what Brackett writes, that some humanization of her character became necessary. Therefore, she was given a scene in which she explained what made her tick. I suppose that's what makes Mr. Luft describe her as drawn with much charm and noblesse. About the audience's reaction to her, I can only report that she ended by going to a labor camp amid the delighted laughter of American audiences. There's the ambivalence, however, whether the audience laughed at the guards having to guard guards who go out with Marlene Dietrich. And in any event, Brackett seems to have drawn on the earlier ending of the script in this response. So the denazification of Erika von Schlüter, the process by which former Nazis got re-educated by Allied procedures and trials, is not really represented in the movie. Instead, one can say that the character of Erika von Schlüter had been denazified in the various plot transformations from scripts to the film. In any event, the dialogue between Brackett and Luft took place four years after the release of the film and was in sharp contrast to the virtually unanimous positive reception in 1948. One can see why reviewers and audiences liked the film. What made it visually stunning was Wilder's extensive use of footage actually filmed in Berlin, where Wilder had returned in 47 for outdoor shooting, as promised by the credit line. A large part of this picture was photographed in Berlin. In fact, Billy Wilder took so much footage of destroyed Berlin that the recent film, A Good German, could use the old footage from the Billy Wilder archive as backdrop for a terrible flop of a movie otherwise. From the introductory sequence showing ravaged Berlin from the air and the black market scene at Brandenburg Gate, to John's Jeep ride, to Erica's apartment and the delegation's guided tour, up to the last car ride to the Lorelei, the haunting omnipresence of the ruins of Berlin contributes greatly to the effect of the film. Since much of it was actually shot at the Paramount Studios, were sets of the Lorelei and of Eric, which was based on a famous bar in Berlin called the Femina Bar, and of Erica's dramatically ruined apartment had been built, and none of the main actors ever went to Berlin for the filming. The illusion that one is always in Berlin was largely created with the help of the most advanced process shooting technique then available, using services of specialists like Farcio Edouard, who had won 2 Oscars for his skill, helped to integrate the clearly focused rear projection footage rather seamlessly into the film. I also, at some point, should apologize that I didn't know that there's a software program that I just learned about. I went with a videotape and photographed from a TV set, so the frames are not as clear as they could be. So the illusion, as I said, that the technique was so natural in A Foreign Affair that the presence of the ruins seems to be so direct as to have an effect on characters and action. The scene in which Phoebe and John are watching the made-up Nazi newsreel that Billy Wilder meticulously recreated to show Erica next to Hitler, and that's the denouement of her deep implication into the past, and which employs essentially the same technique, the same apparatus as process shooting, creates a vague visual echo of the rear projection footage and a momentary illusion of simultaneity of occupation presence and of Nazi past, calling attention to the technique in the manner of romantic irony, as if the sequence were a self-conscious comment on process shooting. The weird humor of the newsreel sequence is strengthened by the fact that the Hitler actor looks like a French, as a French reviewer pointed out, more like Charlie Chaplin's funny incarnation than like the somber original. The beginning of A Foreign Affair specifically echoes Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl's propaganda movie on the Nuremberg rally of 1934. In both films, a plane arrives from above the clouds and casts its shadow over a city. Riefenstahl's sun aglow Nuremberg, with its castle and a wide promenade on which uniformed men are marching, Wilder's ruinscape of Berlin, the shadow of the plane now even evoking associations with a bomber plane. The plane lands to a reception, the over-the-top hailing of the Nazi crowd for Riefenstahl and the small military band for Wilder, and lets its passengers descend a gangway, Riefenstahl's Hitler with swastika band on his left arm, Wilder's congressional delegation with their identifying US flags on their left arms. In the Nazi newsreel, Erica, a critic found, seemed to be made up to look like Riefenstahl, which may be another visual gag. The central plot triangle is driven home in, visually in many, many single frames of the film with John positioned between Erica and Phoebe. Wilder employs black humor-like visual gags, among them showing a Bismarck statue from behind with the Nazi propaganda inscription, "Victory is certain to us," still painted on it in a completely devastated area near the black market at Brandenburg Gate. A Foreign Affair is also a film in which sound technique and oral effects make a significant difference. Most important, the movie is very rich musically. Frederick Hollander's 3 songs, all performed by Marlene Dietrich, are not only high points of the movie, but the songs are visually and textually integrated into the film, from the overture medley to the closing notes. Motifs from Hollander's songs are recognizable throughout the film, and the lyrics of the songs echo what has been seen or heard in dialogue. Porcelain figures appear on the black market before one hears the black market song's line, "You want my porcelain figure." That song highlights the theme of the centrality of exchange that governs not only metamorphoses from cake to mattress, but also the human change that Erica has undergone from the Nazi years to her current fraternization phase. Or that Phoebe embodies when she poses as the German girl, Gretchen Gesundheit, a full name that she can think of as a surname, and when she wears the dress she got at the black market in return for her typewriter, when instead of smelling out the moral malaria in Berlin, as she puts it early on, she actually wants to go to the bar she herself calls a sewer. When Phoebe, with her blonde braided hair, she has already posed as Gretchen at this point, is seen in front of a map of Germany reacting to Colonel Plummer's briefing, the viewer may wonder whether she, rather than glamorous Erica, who sports an international Hollywood look, is the real German allegory. All the more so since Phoebe also passes as a German girl a second time when the Lorelei is raided. The Black Market song, with composer Hollander at the piano, illuminates then this general condition of exchangeability.
Thank you.
So you may have noticed that John lights a cigarette, puts it in his mouth as he watches Erica sing. Erica casually takes it from John, puffs, strolls back to the musicians, then puts it between the lips of the pianist Frederick Hollander, creating a strange visual triangle of two men and a woman united by the same cigarette, the universal currency at the Lorelei and at the Black Market. And one almost thinks of a homecoming of Hollander, Billy Wilder, and Marlene Dietrich to the Blue Angel world, which is always in the background. That appears also in Hollander's autobiography, writing about that phase. And on the other hand, when he discovers Phoebe in the audience, you have the problem. This is the next song. The two other Hollander songs are also seamlessly integrated. Phoebe says that she is not in the mood for laughs, and John asks Phoebe what she does for laughs and tears. Sometime before, Erica sings Illusions with such wonderful lines as, "Want to buy some illusions, slightly used, just like new, such romantic illusions, and they're all about you. I sell them all for a penny. They make pretty souvenirs. Take my lovely illusions, some for laughs, some for tears." So during the last stanza of the song, a shot shows a duplicitous John and Phoebe at table while Erica is reflected in mirror moving toward them. Erica's reflection comes between Johnny and Phoebe and serves as a reminder of Phoebe's romantic illusions. The tune of Illusions can be heard again when John takes Phoebe home to her billet and she is at her most enamored. The movie ends with a Hollander song, this is just from a publicity shot, The Ruins of Berlin, which speaks of the subdued hope for a new beginning. A brand new spring is to begin out of the ruins of Berlin. Of course, the viewer has seen plenty of ruins at this point. In the movie, the song is also quadrilingual and thus makes audible the four-power status of the occupied German capital. Wilder was adamant about letting the film have a naturally multilingual ambiance. The film should be made in just one version, the American speaking English and broken German, the German speaking German and broken English, the Russian speaking Russian, etc. All three Hollander songs back up and reinforce the themes of the film. Black Market, Lost Illusions, Ruins of Berlin, all refer directly to central elements of it, while also alluding to and transforming into a post-war world Marlene Dietrich's earlier Hollander repertoire from the Blue Angel. So the past that had been so brutally ended when the Nazis took power is somehow attempted to be recaptured, and in that kind of a scene you almost think of everything else as an intrusion. And there is a melancholy that one feels under the comedy and the sarcasm. A wonderful musical gag is the candy bar number, which literalizes the popular song Daisy Bell. You know, Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, Drew. When two GIs, Mike and Joe, invite Phoebe for a fraternization ride on a bicycle built for two, as if the tandem had materialized visually, had stepped out of the song and with a raunchier text than the original. Fräulein, Fräulein, willst du ein Candy Bar? Schön, Freund, Fräulein, you like GIs, nicht wahr? One remembers in this scene, too, that Operation Candy Bar was one of the working titles for A Foreign Affair. The most extended musical joke may be John's ride from the Black Market to Erica's apartment. Wilder lets John, who has just exchanged Dusty's birthday cake for a mattress, drive a Jeep called Kidney Killer to Erica through the rear-projected and quite overwhelmingly depressing ruins of Berlin, but sets the sequence to the surrealistically incongruous, cheery musical background of Rodgers and Hart's song, Isn't It Romantic? Wilder may be specifically parodying Ruben Mamoulian's famous opening of Love Me Tonight from 1932, casting John Lund in the role of Maurice Chevalier, Marlene Dietrich in Jeanette MacDonald's part, and Ruined Berlin as a substitute for romantic Paris. It's hard to imagine a more inappropriate juxtaposition than that between the amorous John with his mattress sticking out of the Jeep and the devastated streets to which he is driving in long takes, and the equally inappropriate but catchy love song enhances the incongruity. John then whistles the opening bar of Isn't It Romantic while Erica's brushing her teeth. Originally, the script had him whistling O du lieber Augustin, a mischievous children's song about a boy who has lost everything that would rub in the devastation the viewer has just seen outside and now sees inside Erica's apartment. Whereas Isn't It Romantic speaks to the film's sexual energy John feels toward Erica amidst the ruins of Berlin. In his interview with Billy Wilder, Volker Schlöndorff suggests a counterpoint between music and visual footage in the scene, but Wilder claims that he simply used the tune here and in some other movies because Paramount owned the rights to it and didn't have to pay for it. And indeed, when you watch his Sabrina, it is awash in different renditions of Isn't It Romantic? Now, comic visual and sound effects, oh no, this, I didn't want to go there yet. Oops, I'm sorry, I have to go back. How do I go to, there, okay, I wanted to be black. Comic visual and sound effects make A Foreign Affair a rich filmic experience, but it is the wit of the script, written by Wilder and Brackett, known as the happiest pair in Hollywood at the time, that makes the film unforgettably funny. When New Hampshire Congressman Pennicott observes Berlin children playing baseball surrounded by ruins, he says cheerily, "One thing they don't have to worry about around here is breaking windows." Plummer states that in Berlin there's rubble of all kinds, mineral, vegetable, animal. And Erica wisecracks to Phoebe, "Let's go up to my apartment. It's only a few ruins away from here." This was, by the way, a rewrite from the earlier scripts, "My apartment is just around the corner." Congressman Salvatore from the Bronx, who is modeled on Vito Marcantonio, insists on recognizing Russian artillery contribution to the destruction of Berlin as if that were a commendable accomplishment, and objects to dollar diplomacy. "If you give a hungry man a loaf of bread, that's democracy. If you leave the wrapper on, it's imperialism." That seems to be an allusion to leftist opposition to the Marshall Plan. Both Phoebe and Erica contribute to some hilarious dialogues. "I wonder what holds up that dress," Phoebe says, when she sees Erica strapless in the Nazi newsreel. John responds, "Must be that German willpower." Phoebe's local pride in Iowa is lambasted repeatedly. 62% Republican, thank you, is how she answers John's initial question, "How is good old Iowa?" Later, Phoebe talks about changes in her state. "We had the lowest juvenile delinquency rate in this country till 2 months ago." When Johnny asks what happened, she responds, "A little boy in Des Moines took a blowtorch to his grandmother, and we fell clear down to 16th place. It's humiliating." And John tells Phoebe, "You're not a Nazi. Don't tell me it's subversive to kiss a Republican." Later, "I don't even know your first name, Congresswoman, darling." So when Phoebe wears the dress that she bought at the black market, pinned up high, John comments, "It's kind of high. What is it, a turtleneck evening gown?" And when she asks him after he has fixed the dress by taking out pins, "John, where did you learn so much about women's clothes?" His response is, "My mother wore women's clothes." When Erica notices Phoebe's black market dress, she sneers, "Oh, it's stunning, but haven't you got it on backwards?" When Erica's arrested, she tries to flirt with that wonderful Colonel Plummer, as she tells him, but after playing along with it, Plummer says, "Only most of the time they call me delicious," he tells her off, "Miss von Schlüter, I've become a grandfather today, let's not be silly." And this may have been doubly amusing to the audience in 1948, since Millard Mitchell was actually 2 years younger than Marlene, the birth of whose grandson, Michael Riva, that same year, had earned Marlene Dietrich the popular epithet, the world's most glamorous grandmother. Even in that scene, there's a little glimmer of Marlena's resourcefulness, daring, and verve that makes Erica's seemingly unprincipled flirtatiousness with Plummer, with the MPs, a more sympathetic figure, and certainly much more so than was the earlier conception of Erica von Schlüter's character, who was headed for forced labor at Stalingrad. The effect of much of the humor is that A Foreign Affair makes a joke not only of Nazi pretensions, but also of all the cliches and cant of military occupation, of provincial moral indignation at fraternization, and of American righteousness about re-education and denazification. "Now that we've won the war, we must not lose the peace," John says piously to Phoebe at the beginning in order to explain why he does not want a home leave, when in fact it's his affair with Erica, you know, peace spelled in a different way, that makes him want to stay in Berlin. Alluding to John's affair with Erica, Plummer tells him, "I know you were among the first 10 men to cross the Remagen Bridge. I also know why you were in such a hurry." And Plummer muses more generally, "Sometimes I wonder if it isn't an awful waste of money to import 11,000 ping pong tables for the recreation of you young men." The result is that the movie is extraordinarily balanced, which is why reviewers could find it more realistic and convincing than the heavier melodramas of the occupation which appeared at the same time, like Berlin Express, which Wilder managed to accomplish by keeping John relatively characterless as an occupying everyman, very much attracted erotically to Erica, while seemingly ready to settle with Phoebe, with whom the most intimate scenes include a kiss she makes impossible for a while by reciting Longfellow and whistling Shine on Harvest Moon. On the one hand, the film supports Plummer's wisecracking and grandfatherly smart approach to re-education, and Millard Mitchell embodies the figure excellently, both in his jokes at expense of Germany's Nazi past and in his good-humored devotion to reconstruction and helping establish democracy. His speech to the congressional delegation is the heart of this side of a foreign affair. When we moved into Germany, we found a country of open graves and closed hearts, clenched fists, I think one could say. We had to eliminate things that breed political unrest and military aggression. We've tried to make them free men and give them some dignity. We had to take 4 million displaced persons and return them to their homes. That's a little hard if you don't have a home to start with. We've helped them start a free press and institute parliamentary government. They've just had the first free elections in 14 years. It's been so long they didn't know what to do with it. It was like handing the village drunk a glass of water. What I want to point out is that it's a tough, thankless, lonely job. We're trying to lick it as well as we can. So that's the one side. On the other hand, there is, apart from such speeches, not much filmic evidence of things changing much for better under occupation. The waiter at the Lorelei bows deeply when ex-Gestapo officer Bergel shows up, as if the Nazis could return to power any time. And the single scene in which we see John at work in his denazification office, that's actually his job in the film, it inspires little confidence in the success of that effort and some cause for black humor. A father and his son make deep bows when they leave, correcting their first impulse or clacking their heels. But the issue is that the little boy, Gerhard Meyer, keeps drawing swastikas all over the neighborhood. The father grabs the chalk away from the boy and says to John, "I will break his arm." The following dialogue ensues. "Herr Meyer, we've dissolved the Gestapo. Meyer, no food, Börschen. I will lock him in a dark room into..." "Why don't you shove him in a gas chamber?" "Yes, Herr Kapitän." "Listen, Bub, we've done away with concentration camps. Now you just take him around to a GYA, one of our German youth clubs. Some baseball and a little heel clicking is what he needs." "Yes, Herr Kapitän." As they leave, Meyer is seen from behind with a chalked swastika on his back. So the scene makes the authoritarian Nazi father ridiculous, but it doesn't exactly instill confidence in the growth of democratic youth by denazification. I'm going to end. The film's dominant focus on John and Erica as an allegorical enactment of an American-German encounter during the occupation makes the political goals seem like a joke, a mere pretext for sexual banter. Colonel Plummer may believe the army is bringing democracy to Germany, but the viewer sees John bringing a mattress to Erica. And the dialogue that follows is an excellent example of the satirical approach to the themes of denazification and re-education. Erica, "Where did you get it?" And says, "A friend of mine baked it." Of course, the exchange from the cake to the mattress. "Only you're not going to get it. Should I care whether you sleep or not?" "Johnny, for 15 years, we haven't slept in Germany. First it was Hitler screaming on the radio, then the war of nerves, then the victory celebrations, then the bombing and all the furniture. See," and she shows the mattress, "that's the one I hate worse. Give me that mattress, Johnny." And John says, "No mattress will help you sleep. What you Germans need is a better conscience." And so Erica says, "I have a good conscience. I have a new Führer now. Heil Johnny." And she raises her hand, ultimately resting it on his shoulder, and the frame shows a nice parallel between Marlene Dietrich and the Baroque putti on the wall. He says, "You heil me once more and I'll knock your teeth in, you'll bruise your lips. Why don't I choke you a little or break you in two or build a fire under you, you blonde witch?" And as they're about to kiss, they are arrested by a knock on the door. "Who is that?" And John says, with my luck, "It's Eisenhower." So the harbinger of American-style democracy seems to be acting out a rather kinky fantasy. They have a crackling relationship, as Wilder said. All sides are presented with comic verve, and at the end, the viewer has to decide what the film does not. in thinking about the American occupation of Germany after World War II, is it plumbers? We have helped them to start a free press and institute parliamentary government, or Erika's Heil Johnny that best defines the moment. A Foreign Affair cuts through the ideological rhetoric of the occupation politics and tells a very special love story indeed. Perhaps Billy Wilder's motto for this film could already be the one that made the ending of Some Like It Hot so unforgettable, Nobody's Perfect, the line that Wilder also was to choose for his tombstone. Thank you. Happy to take questions, and also if some of you want to stay for 9 minutes and 25 seconds afterwards, there's the sequence from Johnny getting the mattress at the black market until the Heil Johnny scene and the Eisenhower clip, so you get it rather than in my terrible stills as an actual cinematic sequence. Ready? Yeah. Yes.
Publicity for the film showed how it was perceived around the world.
So I have to shout a little bit.
You mentioned that the publicity for the film discussed how it was perceived around the world. How was it perceived around the world? When did it have people pushing the film?
I've only found a French review. I haven't seen any reviews from Britain or from Germany. And I'm not sure whether it actually was shown in Germany before the 1970s. So I can't tell you more. I did, you know, the usual digital search and look at all the secondary literature, and there was that one French review that showed up that heavily focused on the newsreel and on the mock newsreel. It was, you know, certainly on the American press, just overwhelmingly positive. Yes.
Do you know whether Wilder was aware of some films that were beginning to be made in Germany at the time, starting in 1946, the so-called rebel films?
Right. I think he did see Keutner, and he certainly saw Berlin Affair while he was making a foreign, what's it called, Berlin Story, while he was making a Foreign Affair from the American side. I don't know whether he saw any of the others. He, as you know, I mean, was in 1945 deeply engaged in the film industry, but his proposal to reorganize it was not taken up. So I don't know how much direct involvement he had. I think in 1947, when he came back, he saw a few films, but I didn't see, I looked at all the biographies and the interviews, and I didn't see any more comments.
I was just curious because of the use of rubble, especially in the early German rubble films, or in Russell Lee's film. Yeah. It's always it's often atmospheric and used almost as a character, where the city, the rubble of the city,
right.
The character. I was just
right.
Curious whether he was modeling any of his rubble scenes after these models, or if it was just divorced from them.
Yeah. I think, you know, all he needed to do was see one film, and he probably got the genre right away. And what he does with it is, of course, use it for its comic potential, which was so unusual on the. And, you know, Trümmer stuff is always very serious backdrop, you know, reminding you of broken civilization. And for Wilder, you know, he always has metaphors like it's like a moldy Roquefort cheese. It's, you know, what one of the congressmen says when he looks down at Berlin, and the other congressman gets seasick from the plane when he hears all the food associations with rubble. So I think he thinks of a essentially, you know, tragic setting as a source of, you know, his weird sense of black comedy that, you know, would immediately distinguish him from that whole genre of the German films of the same time. Yes?
When were the Germans first allowed to see it?
Well, that item, I was first allowed to see it in the early 1970s. There was a film festival in Berlin that had a Billy Wilder retrospective. Billy Wilder came, and they showed this film. I'd never heard of it. And, you know, I was just on the floor laughing. I had never seen anything like it. And 1-2-3 at that time also wasn't known, you know, so Billy Wilder with these two fantastic Berlin films. So I don't know whether it was released. I don't think it was ever dubbed, so I doubt that it was released. So all the German films, American films coming to Germany were dubbed and usually edited in the dubbing. You know, you probably know the most famous is Casablanca, where Humphrey Bogart is a former drug dealer, and Ingrid Bergman has gone back into drug dealing with Paul Henreid, and so Bogart is tempted for a while, but then basically he doesn't participate in the drug dealing. There are no Nazis in it, there's no Marseillaise. The film only lasts about an hour. That was the dubbed German version of Casablanca. So I can imagine that this film wasn't exactly a dream offering for the internal German way of looking at what re-education and building up democracy should be. So I honestly don't know. It's something I have to. This is the first time I should say that I've tried out this talk, and will ultimately become a chapter of the book. So this is a very good suggestion, as is also looking for more European reviews. I'm grateful for all those comments that you've made, but I can't.
Under the occupation, were the Germans allowed to make films showing the post-war situation, showing the occupation?
Well, yes. The occupation wasn't until a little bit later that it gets directly shown. I mean, there are funny films, too, about the occupation in the early 50s. I don't think there was a prescription about it. Of course, the information control, that sort of was in place until the various states at which Germany gained sovereignty, but it certainly wasn't a very common common motif. I saw a movie as a kid called Columbus Discovers Krajewinkel, and it's the American army occupying a small town, and a baron figures out how to play a pinball machine that you always win. And the Americans put out, it was to get Germans, democratized to play pinball, and this baron, every time wins the grand total prize, and that sets up the drama. So it's sort of a very weird way of getting at occupation in a snobbish way, if you want. Any other questions or comments?
Yes. The chalk swastika actually reminded me of the film M, because that's probably the only film where I know that someone carries.
Very good.
Without knowing
absolutely.
It, chalk on his back, and
I haven't seen that in any of the secondary literature. It's a wonderful suggestion. I think you're right, because it's the coat.
The first moment you first showed that, I was kind of like, wait, is that from M?
Amazing. And it's just that still at that moment, because of course it's a dramatic scene, and first he draws a chalk on the denazification desk, and the father wipes it off with his sleeve, and then it seems the thing is resolved, and then they march out also in this sort of mock stormtrooper way, and then you see the swastika on the back. You're absolutely right. It's like when he stands in front of that the strange little square light, and Peter Lorre has the M in the back. Great. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. The question I would add to it. I know the film very little. But all the subversive moments that you talked about, or most of them, seem to be located in the dialogue. And I was for a moment wondering, M is often seen as an anticipation the Nazis, but in a way it's not the murderer, but it's also the pursuit of
right,
the murderer.
So
in a way there's an ambivalence, who is actually the fascist subject there.
Right.
And I wonder if there's, on this image level of the film, if there is something that actually that is more serious than actually the subversion that happens on the level of the comedy, which is very much a verbal comedy.
Right. Well, I think I tried to show, I gave you some examples that the comedy is visual, the comedy is also musical, and works with soundtrack in relationship to image. I think Wilder is very much aware of movie predecessors, that's why I think your suggestion of M is so excellent, and turns what are serious images or songs or ideas into something that he can use in a sarcastic and mocking way. And at the end of it, the effect is similar, though, to what, that's why I say it's a kind of balanced movie, because you don't end up really, really cheering. Certainly don't cheer for John and Phoebe getting married. That's completely downplayed and weird and unconvincing at the end. So there is a kind of balance that is struck. And so the question, who is righteous, what is really in the air, is a serious question that gets raised by that balance. And I try to trace it through all these different storylines, because the film started out as such a clear-cut film against a Nazi bitch. You know, that was the thrust of it. And in all these stages, you end up with so much more of an ambiguous film that moves exactly into the direction of what you described.
Yes? My question is really about Marlene Dietrich as this figure who you point out the irony of the fact that here's this anti-fascist who then is playing the Nazi in this film. But on the other hand, it's even more interesting that she is, even though she's not physically returning to Berlin in this case, but she's the kind of tossed out Berliner who defected and left the Berlin population alone in the war, basically. So there's this kind of resentment against her. And I wondered if, we don't quite know the reception history, but I wondered if you had thought about that angle as well as complicating it even further in terms of her.
It's, in her own autobiography, Marlene Dietrich talks about the scene that I already told you where, you know, Billy Wilder persuades her to play the part. She doesn't mention there the relationship to Germany at all, but then she goes into the censor coming onto the set and, you know, basically saying she can't lie in bed, you know, something. So she's sort of maybe misremembering a little bit because the final script had already been changed, but so her beef in that chapter on foreign affair is with the American censor rather than with the German audiences. Though, of course, she has quite a bit. I recently looked, you know, she had a very long relationship with Ernest Hemingway, and they exchanged about 80 letters each, where, you know, Hemingway called her my little Kraut and, you know, other endearing things, and she always called him Papa. In one letter, Hemingway says, I hope you like my new book that I'm sending you, which was Across the River and Into the Trees, as much as I liked you in A Foreign Affair. Hemingway keeps telling her, you did the right thing, no matter what the Germans are saying, and it must have been a hard thing because you have relatives there, but, you know, you were a brave girl, and, you know, and get rid of this boy in Paris. So he has a lot of direct comments on the flack that she received exactly at the time that he writes her this praising letter. I came across it totally by coincidence because these letters were just this year freed for public viewing in the Kennedy Library in Boston. And so to find that Hemingway actually said, you know, I hope you like my book as much as I liked you in A Foreign Affair was a pretty neat sentence. But he makes a lot of reference where she doesn't in that section in her autobiography. Any other? Well, I think I'm sorry, yeah.
Wondering, one would have a sense of, a writer is having so much complete control over a product, but Wilder seems in the position of someone who has been kind of run over by a steamroller, that keeps having these changes foisted upon him. How did he relate to those sorts of changes? Was he happy with the end products?
I think he was happy. You know, most of the I think the censorship were the only changes that really came from the outside. The earlier changes were all revisions that he and Brackett made from they had a story that Paramount owned, so that was a factor. So they had to use a little bit of that, and the writer of that story got credit in the final film credits. Then they wanted to change the thing, and I think it was exactly the period when Marlene Dietrich gets signed on that the character of Erica von Schuto, becomes freer from that earlier thing. And then the censor, I think, was just a way of playing hide and seek with making some cuts that would look right. You know, she doesn't wear a pajama anymore and she isn't lying in bed. But apart from that, quite a few of the things, Black Market is, and all the specific things that they mentioned, he actually just kept in the film. So self-censorship, I guess, wasn't as complete. I had hoped you would ask a question that I couldn't answer today because I brought the answer to the question that you asked on Tuesday. Okay. And I can give it to you. It's here. This is the answer. If you have any suggestions for me how to go on with this is, you know, still in an early stage for a section of a book on tales of the 1940s, tales of the occupation, I would be grateful. You can always reach me by email. I'd, you know, be happy to get comments. You're the first audience where I've tried this out, and would be grateful for it. Martha, thank you very much. Well, maybe we can. Oh, no. Okay, let me just see.